Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, actor-producer Diallo Riddle talks about his very first job at an amusement park.
I went to Six Flags Over Georgia because they hire 15-year-olds to operate like some of the heaviest equipment in the world. Like, if you think about it, every time you get on a roller coaster, you're putting your life in the hands of someone who can't even vote. And this time I made it to the merchandising department, which was great. I feel like it served all my social skills well. You know, people would come in, I'd say, hey, would you like to buy these plush toys? You know, like, I was excelling in this department. I quickly rose to the rank of manager.
Today on Storyworthy, actor Diallo Riddle from the smash show Marlin talks about his first job at Six Flags Over Georgia. Stay close.
Hey, it's Diallo Riddle, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. I'm so glad you guys tuned in today, whether you're a longtime fan of the show for over 500 episodes now, you guys. We're heading into our eighth year. Yeah, today is episode 502, and whether you've been listening to all those episodes or you're a brand new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week, which was actually a live show at the Improv, and it was Story Smash, our game show. And it was so funny, I can't even tell you. Danny Zucker was one of the judges, Matt Oswalt, Brian Finkelstein played the game, Eli Braden was there, Laura House was there. It was funny, it was tight. Go back and listen to Story Smash from last week, because I'm telling you, it's super funny. By the way, Diallo, you would love my game show, Story Smash.
I feel like I love it already, and I know some of the people that you named.
It's amazing. You spin a wheel, whatever it lands on, That's the story. Go.
Love it.
It's just that fast.
I'm down.
See? That's perfect.
And by the way, I haven't listened to episode 5. I'm going to go back and listen to that one.
I want you to.
I am.
I want you to. Thanks, friend. All right, you guys. But today, stick with me because you've tuned into a really interesting episode with an incredibly interesting man. His name is Diallo Riddle, and you guys know him. He's a writer and an actor and a producer, and he brings forth the topic, my first job. And we've all had a first job. And when I think about, like, I'm trying to think of, like, because I had, like, first jobs, like, as a babysitter or, like, you know, like, taking care of my neighbor's pet.
Sure.
But my first job would be when I was 15. I lied and said I was 16 and waitressed at a pizza parlor.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And they paid me under the table.
And what state was that in? Was that
it was
in
Pennsylvania? Pittsburgh, okay. Pennsylvania.
It so was you had called, to be 15 to be employed in
No, you had to be 16.
You had to be 16.
But I lied. And this was like a totally under the table business. I mean, it was all so shady. Yeah. And so
pizza industry in general runs on cash.
I swear to God, that's exactly right. So it was pizza, Stromboli, and calzones. And they called me baby girl because I was a baby. I was a child.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I made some money. I snuck cigarettes in and smoked in the bathroom. Because I thought that'd be cool, you know, from the older people.
So you were an underage employee smoking cigarettes in the bathroom.
USA.
This is so pre-Me Too on so many levels.
Anyway, I'm super excited to hear your story, but I'm also excited to talk to you about so many things you have going on. And I'm so impressed and happy for you because you have a rich history in acting and writing and producing. But like right now, there's three major things happening.
Yeah.
So you're on the summer hit series Marlin, which is on NBC.
Yep, that network.
And that's you play Marlin's best friend.
Yep, I do.
And then IFC just picked up your series Sherman Showcase,
which I am so excited about, and it's going to debut in 2019. And there'll be a lot of things coming up that are completely part of that rollout. So. Stay tuned. All the people who appreciated shows like Portlandia and Documentary Now and Brockmire, like, we're so happy to find a partner in this show called Sherman Showcase. And I'll admit, it was when I was watching the Talking Heads episode of Documentary Now that I literally called up Bashir, who's my writing partner. I was like, I know what network. I was like, we shouldn't take this idea to any other network. Let's take it to IFC. If they can do a half-hour parody of Stop Making Sense, we can do Sherman Showcase at that network.
That is so fabulous to find a match like that.
Yeah.
Right off the bat.
Yeah. I was like, whoever the executives over there, they're clearly intoxicated. Let's go there.
And this is
they're
a
not
musical.
Watching the network. I mean, like, this should not even
they'll,
happen.
They'll go off. They'll take a chance. But this is a musical variety sketch show.
Yes, it is. And I mean, there have been other sketch shows that had a lot of music in them, but I think that there's just something very unique about this show. We are trying to do a show that will not just be what it is in concept, which is there was this show that was a lot like Soul Train or American Bandstand that was on the air for 45 years called Sherman Showcase, hosted by one host. And through the years, you see him aged up and down, the hairstyles, the clothing, the music, everything matches that particular year, the things they're talking about, the particular artists on the show. But more importantly, we want that show to be the kind of touchstone that In Living Color was, or early SNL, or, you know, before SNL figured out what it was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, I think about, like, the Chappelle Show. There's so many ways that we can go with this show.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we're still finding out what it is as well. But the thing that makes us excited about it is it's not just a show. It's eventually going to be something that we can take out on tour. Like, you'll be able to go to Sherman Showcase and you'll see, like, some of our made up fictional bands perform the original songs that we do on the show. Bashir and I wrote a lot of original music.
So does Bashir play Sherman or do you?
Bashir plays Sherman.
Okay.
And
who is he mirroring that off of? Like the Soul Train guy, or
it's a little bit like Don Cornelius, but I would point out that, like, you know, I think that in some ways Don Cornelius is sort of like the archetypical older black man. I think that Sherman's is far more unhinged than that.
Yeah.
And I think that,
maybe a touch of that Gong Show guy. What was his name? The you know, the guy that played the
absolutely
the host of the Gong Show.
No,
he
think,
was wild, and he did that dance
and
before every show.
100%. I think that they're quite everybody from Wink Martindale,
right, with that long stick
to a bit of Bob Barker. I think he can be a lot of different hosts, but I think more importantly, like, Bashir is going to bring his own natural comedic instincts to this part, and he's going to own it in a way that's going to be, you know. It's not going to just be like Don Cornelius from Soul Train or Dick Clark from American Bandstand. He's going to be his own host. And we really just, in a way, we use Sherman as an entry point to do all the sort of sketch material that we think is funny. For example, we're pretty sure there's going to be this whole running gag that this is not the only time Sherman tried to have his own TV show. So in the 80s, he was the star of his own sort of 80s sitcom called Larvel. And
what does Larvel mean?
Well, you know, we're still working that out, but we think it's like, you know, we'll show you the opening credit sequence for Larvel. But, you know, LeVar was a person who, you know, needed some more friends on his sitcom to make it work. And it, really, this show is an excuse to let our freak flag fly, so to speak. When we were at Fallon, we did a lot of sketches where Bashir would play, like, you know, a space-obsessed, you know, hip-hop New York fan. New York Yankees fan, or he would play like a very James Brown-esque singer. What we want to do with this show is have Bashir and myself and some of our, you know, friends, including executive producer of the show, John Legend, play other characters that you don't usually get to see them play. What we found is that many musicians and rappers and singers, they really want to be comedians.
Yeah, they want to be outside the box. They want to do things that they don't always get
exactly.
to do. What a blast.
And why shouldn't they? Like,
yeah.
What we tend to find is that, like, they all have ideas like, oh, this would be so funny. I'll never forget one time Pharrell sort of cornered us backstage at Fallon. And he pitched us the sketch that was far too risque for NBC, but it's the perfect kind of sketch for Sherman Showcase.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is we want to go back to all these people who've pitched us ideas over the years. You know, we worked with everybody from Maya Rudolph to Drake. Like, we want to go back to all these people and say, hey, there was that idea that you want to do. Now we have the venue to do it.
It's going
to
be amazing.
Let's do that.
And you can go through the decades because it spans time.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can be in any time space, really.
Exactly.
The costumes can change. The music will change.
100%. I mean, like, the conceit of the show is that the show's been on for 45 years. So, really, the show debuted in 1974, and we can do literally every musical genre since 1974.
I love it.
And we plan to, because we're, you know, I still DJ sometimes, and, you know, Bashir's just a connoisseur of music. Like, when we first met, like we met with a lot of shared interests, and one of the weirder things that we were both sort of into was Britpop. So one of the nuts we're trying to crack is, how do you form a black Britpop band in the 90s that is basically like Oasis and Blur and Pulp and Suede and a lot of the weird bands that, you know, Bashir and I would listen to, and our black friends would be like, what is that?
So it's exciting because it has the element of being a live performance, but also it'll be filmed and you'll have the fictional through line of Sherman's life.
Yes.
And I hope he has like a lot of wives and stuff. I think that'd be funny.
Oh, that's a given. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. We actually, let me take a step back and say that one of the reasons this idea came about was that my wife and I went to Vegas one time and we paid a lot of money to see Flight of the Conchords perform live. And then we paid a lot of money to see whoever was DJing that night. I think it was like Calvin Harris or somebody like that. And I was like, we went from one casino to another casino. We played separately for comedy and separately for music. Wouldn't it be great if there was one place that you could go, laugh, you know, laugh your heart off, and then laugh your heart off? I made that up.
laugh your ass off, I think it is.
Well, I pushed the two together. But then after like 10 or 11 p.m., like you get to hear great music. Yeah. And then after 1 a.m., because it's Vegas, you get to hear like the best DJs. A lot of that is what the Sherman live show will be.
Well, this is exciting. And just one more question on that. Why is it called Sherman Showcase? Sherman, because Sherman Oaks?
I feel like the word Sherman has followed me around a lot in my life. Like I grew up in Atlanta. And there's, of course, a Sherman who burned the city down.
Yeah.
And because of, you know, my skin tone, I was actually pro-Sherman. So I had a poster of Sherman up on my wall growing up. I live in Sherman Oaks, which, you know, Sherman Oaks is like its own unique community. I watch, you know, is it Pretty Little Lies?
Big Little Lies.
Big Little Lies. And I was thinking to myself, you know, Sherman Oaks needs its own show.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I think we could call it The Shokes. Yeah. Just putting that out there. Like, people could be like, oh, what part of town are you from? The Shokes.
Because there's a lot. Sherman Oaks is, some of it is very exclusive. And then it kind of goes all the way down to regular apartments.
I think there's like there are a lot of cool things going on in Sherman Oaks that a lot of people don't know about. So that might be a future project. And, you know, I knew that I wanted the show to have a name that included the word showcase. So in this case, I was just like, well, what's a male, because I knew I wanted Bashir to be the host. I was like, what's a male name that starts with S-H? My sister's name is Sean, spelled S-H-A-W-N. Sean Showcase didn't have the ring to it. Sherman's did.
Yeah, and like you said, it definitely has like a connection with you. And then Comedy Central comes along. They pick up your show, Southside, which is about a rent-to-own business on the south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
And you're really trying to show Chicago in a different light.
And this one, yes, and this one is coming out actually sooner than later. This one should be debuting. We originally thought it might even debut in 2018. It's actually looking like it's going to debut January 2019. You know, once again, writing partner Bashir came back from Chicago. He was telling me funny stories about growing up on the South Side, the funny people. And I think we all know funny people back home who didn't come out to Hollywood to try and make it a living being funny. And so what we did is we put those ideas together. We took, you know, something that was real because a friend of his had actually started working at I think it was Rent-A-Center.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling us about the terrible and yet sort of funny times that they would have trying to repossess like a TV, a toaster, you know, and we were just like, wow, that is so bleak. And yet there's something kind of like funny sad about it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's such a thing as funny sad. So what we had to do is we had to try to figure out, well, how do you tell the story of the neighborhood that Bashir grew up in? So that you can contrast that with the way that, like, you know, some politicians will try to paint all of the South Side of Chicago as like this hellhole where it looks like Mad Max and people are running around with like knives and like stuff on their car. And we wanted to do the opposite. Like, we were just like, look, let's show people the real South Side. Let's
just use normal
actors
people
from the South Side.
Yeah.
The majority of the regular cast of the show South Side has never formally acted before. I know that a lot of actors may not love that fact, but like the fact is that we wanted it to be authentic.
I love it. All right, listen, I gotta tell you, we have two things in common.
Okay.
We're both the youngest of six.
Whoa. I don't think I've ever met another youngest of six.
And your sister went to the Peace Corps and I went to the Peace Corps.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
I served in the Kingdom of Tonga.
It's in the South Pacific. She was in Togo.
Really?
Africa, yeah.
When they told me I was going to Tonga, I said, I've always wanted to go to Africa. And they said, no, you're thinking of Togo. And I said, that's what I thought. And they said, no, Tonga, which I never even heard of.
Different part of the world.
Isn't that funny? Anyway, listen, you guys, we're going to get to Diallo's story in just a second. But before we do, I did want to remind you guys to head over to my website, storyworthypodcast.com, and check it out. That's all. All right, you guys, he's here right now. Diallo Riddle. He is an Emmy and WGA nominated writer and actor. And he wrote and performed for Late Night with Jimmy Fallon from 2008 to 2012, which is a long time, including one of the funniest segments I've ever seen in my life, the slow jam with Barack Obama. You wrote that. So your words were coming out of the president.
Which is trippy.
You know, I can't even imagine.
I've never done acid, but I imagine it would be pretty trippy if, like, something came out of your head, you typed it into a computer, and then it came out of the mouth of not just the president of the United States, but just like a person you admire. It was a very bizarre but very fun, cool day.
And in a slow jam fashion, which is the funniest damn thing in the world.
Which, by the way, I'll never forget that we were actually, you know, like anytime we brought on a politician or, you know, for a while it was Brian Williams, like, anytime we brought in somebody to slow jam the news with Jimmy and the Roots, you always coach them on how it would go or how to, like, say a certain line. And in the case of Barack, like, you just figure, like, oh, we should probably tell him, like, the joke is this and the joke is that. Like, not at all. Like, the guy had such natural comedic timing that, like, he nailed it on the first rehearsal.
That is unbelievable.
He nailed it on the absolute first rehearsal. We were just like, do you want to try it again? He was like, don't need it.
That is so interesting. There is an example of somebody in a role that you'd never seen in that other role. So he could come on Sherman's Showcase, maybe do a...
I'm glad you bring it up.
You know what I mean?
I know you listen to the show. Next time you listen to Storyworthy, just get the out of the information and just contact me.
If you could.
She has my info.
Listen, you can find Diallo over on Twitter, at Diallo, D-I-A-L-L-O.
Isn't that great? When you have a name that's so bizarre.
You're so lucky.
You could just be at your first name and just call it a day.
Yeah, it's so fortunate. I love the name Diallo. It's really nice.
Well, you know, it's also from Francophone Africa.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Francophone.
Yeah, so in other words, like the Fouta Jallon Mountains are spelled Fouta, D-I-A-L-L-O-N.
Uh-huh.
So, like, my name technically should be pronounced Jallo, but... You know, if I told people that my name was Jallo, I would get Jello.
It'd be too hard.
I don't want to do that.
Diallo. It's beautiful. I love it. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Diallo Riddle.
In the 90s, I was in high school, and I was a sophomore, and I was about to turn 15. And in the state of Georgia, you can get a job at the age of 15. So I was really looking forward to this. I always wanted to make my own money. Like, that was always something super important to me. So, you know, I went to Six Flags Over Georgia because they hire 15-year-olds. to operate like some of the heaviest equipment in the world. Like, if you think about it, every time you get on a roller coaster, you're putting your life in the hands of someone who can't even vote. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, I applied to Six Flags Over Georgia, and I got funneled into one of two departments that they funnel like the greenest of the green, which is either food and beverage, which means you just serve hot dogs and other overpriced goodies, or grounds, which means you will literally walk around the park with a broom and a pan and just sweep up, and you clean bathrooms and you change the trash cans. So, you know, I like went in there and I told them, like, I am an A student and I really show a lot of initiative and drive, and I'd love to work in merchandise because, you know, that's the gift shop. Those are all the different gift shops in the park. I was immediately hustled into the grounds department. Where I was handed my broom and my pan, and I hated it. Like, as early as the third day, I was like, there's no way I'm going to save up enough money to buy any Sega Genesis games. This is a nightmare. And truth be told, at the end of just 2 weeks on the job, I'll never forget, because, you know, when you work grounds, like, you're there well after the park closes. I didn't even quit. I actually just walked off the job, like... I remember I, like, carelessly threw, like, a big, you know, sack of trash over into one of the dumpsters, walked to my car, and just drove off. And I was just like, well, how much could it hurt me? Like, I'll never work at Six Flags again. At the end of my junior year, the following summer, I was 16, and I was about to become 16. I was like, wow, I really want to work at Six Flags again. But there's no way. They probably blackballed me. I'm probably known as that guy who didn't even complete, you know, 2 weeks. But, you know, this is the 90s, so, you know, technology wasn't what it is now. And so I literally walked back in there and said, hey, I'd really like to work at Six Flags. And they're like, yeah, great, that sounds fantastic. So I was like, sweet, I made it back in. And this time I made it to the merchandising department, which was great. I feel like it served all my social skills well. You know, people would come in, I'd say, hey, would you like to buy these plush toys? You know, like I was excelling in this department. I quickly rose to the rank of manager. Now, as a manager, you have to like manage all the people in the, it's really about people management. Like you have to manage all the 15-year-olds in the store. I'm going to date myself. This is the mid 90s and things were not as they are now. One day I get a call, and I usually worked on the gift store near the Great American Scream Machine roller coaster. But this day they were like, hey, we had a manager call in sick. Can you work the Confederate store? Now the Confederate store was our gift shop in the middle of the park in an area that used to be called Dixieland. Dixieland is no longer a thing. The Confederate store is obviously no longer a thing. But in the mid-90s, you could go into Six Flags Over Georgia and visit the Confederate store where literally every item in the store, not a small store, had the Confederate flag on it. And I went in for work that day. And to those of you who don't know, I am African-American. So I walked in and I felt a lot like that guy in Blazing Saddles. But I walked into the Confederate store and I saw my employees for the day. It was Jill, Don P, and Don D. I'll never forget because there were two... There are two redheaded white guys named Don. And I was just like, okay, well, D is skinnier than Don P. And, you know, it was just an interesting day. Like, I just remember that I sort of started giving, you know, the employees, like, a little bit more extra work to do because it wasn't lost on me that I was working at the Confederate store. And, you know, anytime customers would come in, I'd sort of, like, announce to them, like, hey, welcome to the Confederate store. Let us know if we can help you out. Don P helped this guy. You know, it was a pretty wild time. And, you know, the fact is that over time, you know, like I would make sure that like everybody was treated with respect. But it is pretty remarkable that, you know, that there was such a thing as the Confederate store. But I really enjoyed my first job. Like not every day was as racially as incendiary as that day. Like there were times when I would work the concerts, you know, I think Richard Marx was on tour at the time doing Six Flags. So, you know, I got to hear Hazard and, you know, Angelina and some of the Richard Marx classics. There was something very liberating about going to a job every day, interacting with the public in such a fun way. And no matter what happens to me in my life, whenever people are like, what is the best job you ever had? I'm like, gosh, it might have been when I was 16 working at Six Flags Over Georgia because there was so much freedom there. And it was so much fun. I actually saved up enough money to buy my first car. You know, I saved up $1,300 and bought a Honda Accord from the 80s, but it had four doors. I remember I was like, just no matter what, I want that first car to have not be a hatchback because I just knew that I was going to save up just enough money to get a hatchback. I was like, when I saw it had four doors, it might as well have been a Cadillac. Like, I was like, this is the best car ever. And it had a tape deck. Give me a break. You know, I was like, I can save up and buy a CD player. This is the best car ever. That was like my first time ever having a job, and I sort of miss it, you know, because it was so simple and fun, and I'll never forget it.
You know, that is like such a sweet story. That is so sweet, and I hope so much that my daughter's first job is like that. You know, in terms of like being with friends, taking on some responsibility, but not too much responsibility, and it's not like she's sitting in some, you know, file room filing or something, like she's out getting fresh air. So what was your favorite ride that year at Six Flags? Because that must have been a perk.
It was, but you know, I had been going to Six Flags like almost every day, every summer from the time that I was, you know, is literally as far back as I can imagine. You know, like
was the hangout.
I had ridden all the rides. Yeah, like, and my parents were always like, we didn't have a lot of money, but the one thing that they would splurge on was they would usually find a way to either splurge on a season pass, or even before that, my sister, my number five, my sister had been a sort of a big up manager at Six Flags a long time ago, and so she would give me all her free passes.
Did she help you get the job then?
No, she had long moved on, so I should probably say that there was an 11-year gap between number five and number six.
Yeah, that's amazing. Which meant that
I had a nephew who was 7 days younger than me.
Wow.
Like, kid number one was born 21 years before me.
That's so interesting.
And mom and dad took about a 10, to, like I said, about a
you 10 an ac- year gap. You were an accident.
You know, I don't know anymore. I used to joke, I was like, clearly a mistake, clearly... But Dad used to joke, like, look, you know, there was the 70s were a rough time. There was a lot of turmoil and inflation. And so, like, we needed cheap kicks. So, like, I don't know if I was necessarily an accident or if they just wanted to go one more time, you know, one more time into the breach. They had kids when they were really young.
Yeah.
And so when they had me, they were both in their 40s. What's interesting is I just recently had a child. He's 15 months now. Desmond. Shout out to Desmond.
Aww.
I would say that I am the same age that my father was when he had me. And to me, it's frightening because I always thought of my father as a pretty old dude.
Yeah.
And a pretty old dad.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wow, is Desmond going to look at me and think of me the same way? Because, like, in my brain, I'm forever 24 years old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. First of all, the name Desmond Riddle is the cutest name I've ever heard in my life.
He's named after the Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Desmond Tutu. Yeah. Desmond Riddle. That is beautiful. But listen, your father might have been older in terms of, like, was he active? Did he do things? Was he, you know what
I
mean?
So my father was a painter. Growing up as
an artist painter or a house painter?
An artist painter. So, like, you know, he was trained at L.A. City College in the fine arts, as he used to say. But he eventually rose to quite prominence from his sculptors. In fact, some of his sculptures are on display at the California African American Art Museum.
That's amazing.
As well as the High Museum in Atlanta. He became quite prominent. So you can always Google him and see some of the images. John Thomas Riddle Jr. You know, I'll put it like this. When you're the son of a artist like that, not a house painter, not even like an artist who just
fools,
you know,
around,
find like a rich person and say, hey, you want something green,
yeah,
you know, above your couch? Like, my father wasn't that type. Like, he worked in many mediums, and some of his work is, I hate to use the term, but I think it gets the point across, some of his work is angry. Like, it's not like necessarily like the stuff that people want to buy for their house. That said,
it's like he had to do it. Like, it was in his soul to make this piece of work.
It was in his soul.
That's
and
beautiful.
He even said, like, you know, after doing some initial still lifes, which I think his still lifes are beautiful, after doing some initial work like that, he said, in his opinion, art without any social commentary wasn't worth his time.
Wow.
So, you know, during the Reagan administration, he was prolific, you know, and that says something about our politics.
Yeah. But your dad was the real deal.
But he was the real deal. And what that also meant was that our house was like feast or famine. So I remember, like, some years, like, he would sell a lot of pieces, and then we would go to the Sizzler. You know, but like there were plenty of years when he wouldn't sell very much at all. And, you know, as a kid, I'm so grateful that I didn't focus on the fact that we didn't have a lot of money. But you can definitely feel the tension. Like, if you're like, hey, I want that, you know, I want that toy. And everybody in the house is like, well, you know, we probably aren't going to get that toy.
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, poverty can be a great motivator for you, for everybody, you know?
Totally, yeah.
But also being able to see your parent making money in that way. Like, I hope my daughter sees me, or I know she sees me trying, you know, reaching for my dreams. And, like, it's not about money, you know what I mean? And sometimes I have better years than other years, et cetera. But I want her to see that because then she knows it's possible. Because, like, where I grew up in Pittsburgh, not to bring it to me, but I'm just saying, like, where I grew up, my dad was an accountant, a miserable accountant. He didn't want to be that,
right.
But that's like, he was in that box. And I think a lot of people don't realize you can get out of that box.
Well, but let me also say that my dad wasn't, He always told all of the kids, he was like, I'd love it if you guys were doctors and lawyers and, like, all the professions he saw as stable. But he would always say, if you're going to be an artist, you have to be able to support yourself. So even as an artist, my father took a job with the city of Atlanta, working in, it's not Parks and Recreation, it might be like Arts and Recreation, I forget
what the name
of the particular department was, but that was his 9 to 5. Like, he'd literally be there from 9 to like 5:36,
wow.
He would come home every day at 7. We would hang out for maybe 2 or 3 hours before I went to bed. And then he would go down in our basement and paint until 1 or 2 in the morning.
Amazing.
So he was pulling double duty. Like, he wasn't living just off. But you got to also understand that, like, as a city employee, you're definitely making just enough to meet the mortgage.
Yeah, yeah.
To, you know, keep some clothes on my back. Even though I remember in kindergarten, I feel like there was one sweater I wore every day.
Aww.
I wish there was one picture. Kids today have a million pictures of themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's one picture of me in that sweater, but I can see that sweater so vividly in my brain because I know that I wore it all the time.
Well, you might have just loved that sweater. It might not have been like that's the only sweater you had. You might have loved it because kids do that. Like,
I actually remember thinking to myself, I'm tired of the sweater. I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to wear the sweater anymore. And I also remember that we had a succession. Every car we owned until I was in high school was some variation of a Volkswagen. Like, the first Volkswagen was green, and it was almost like the Flintstone car because the bottom had rotted out, so I could see the street moving underneath
God,
it.
Yeah.
And then the next one was the red Volkswagen. That was the fancy Volkswagen because you couldn't see the road when you were sitting in the car. And then Dad got a Karmann Ghia, which I actually loved.
Those are old school.
That was super old school, and it was a super fun. It was a cool car.
So yeah,
that
it had the engine in the back. The engine
I'm pretty sure. I think Porsche built it, but it's the car that he drives in. It's the car that Michael Myers drives in. So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Is that right?
Yeah,
he drives a Karmann Ghia. That is so funny.
Car. And then that car just became so unreliable. We got our very first new car. I think it was around 93, but it was a Dodge Shadow.
Oh, man.
I thought that was the coolest car because, A, it was new.
Yeah.
And
well,
it had all working
huge
parts. But also, it had like a curved, it had a slight curve on the back of the car. And I was like, wow, it's not a box.
Yeah.
There's a curve on the back of the car.
Right on, man.
So, there you go.
Hey, listen, let me take it real quick back to Six Flags.
Yeah.
So, you just worked there one summer, or two summers.
So, like, I worked there, I would say, one summer officially.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll ever know about that first summer I showed up.
Did you go with your friends? Like, were there after-hours parties for the employees?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then you'd
and
make
by the
out
way,
on the Ferris wheel?
I was friends with all the other managers. So, we can keep the story going a little bit, because there is another sort of funny, like, we would have employee talent shows where, like, everybody would get up and try to, like, sing or rap their favorite songs. And it was the 90s, so I think I was, like, part of an all-male TLC group. And, you know, we might have done some Naughty by Nature songs together. But there was definitely that camaraderie. It was actually one of the first times, because Atlanta was, and I think to a certain extent still is, very segregated. But everybody kind of works at Six Flags.
Yeah.
So it was the first social group of friends that I had where there were any white people.
That's amazing.
And I remember that, you know, it was also one of the first times I ever knew that, like, white kids listened to hip-hop.
Yeah.
So, like, they'd be like, yo, I like this Cypress Hill, yo. And I'd be like, wow, white kids like hip-hop? I thought you guys were still listening to Def Leppard and stuff like that.
That's
but
beautiful.
But, like, that was, it was a really cool clique of people.
Yeah.
It was one of the first groups of people that I knew where somebody in the group smoked weed.
Yeah.
I remember that I this is actually, this is a little bit embarrassing. It's not embarrassing. It's kind of wonderful. It was the first time I had a crush on somebody who wasn't black. Her name was Mandy Turnipseed. I'm not even making that up. Her name was Amanda, but every Amanda in Georgia at the time had to go by Mandy. I don't know. It was required by law. And I had a crush on her for a couple of days, and then she was like, hey, we're going to go back to my friend's house after work. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. So a bunch of us managers, you know, it was very cliquish, like all the managers were friends. We went back to her place, and I'll never forget, but her friend's place actually was like, her friend was dating her brother, and her brother's car was on the friend's front lawn up on blocks, and it just did not seem like my scene. I remember thinking, Mandy, there's too wide a cultural gap here. I'm sorry, Mandy. This is not going to work out. In my brain, by the way.
She
never knew that anything.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You didn't know you were thinking white trash.
A term I would never use. And, I truthfully do feel like, you know, if there was some way to bring, you know, Georgia's impoverished, white population with its, you know, black population, it would be so positive for everybody if we could just literally just convince, hey, put the skin color aside, we're all in the same boat here.
Of course.
But culturally, like, I'll never forget, her brother came out, he was, like, drinking, like, a beer, and it was, like, Pabst Blue Ribbon or something like that. And I literally just thought to myself, you know what,
This
is not my scene.
But if we could all just look to Six Flags Amusement Park,
you
know, for the things that bring us all together, wouldn't that be something?
It really was a special time. You know, like, we had friends. I can't stress it enough. My high school had 3 non-black students.
Wow.
And I still remember Jorge Ramos.
Yeah.
What was it? Tiffany Tran from Vietnam and Joel Blessinger.
And that's
and
it.
Bless his heart. I don't know what happened to Joel, but, like, I think that guy went through some stuff as the only white kid. Like, there were no sort of, like, interracial groups, but at Six Flags, I had Japanese friends, I had white friends, I had Latino friends. Like, it really did bring together the corners of Georgia at that time. I think that nowadays, when I go back and I visit family there, and I have all my nieces and nephews there, like, their cliques are, like, they're interracial but almost by default.
Yeah, right.
You know, but again, it's easy to forget that just 20 years ago, that was not the case.
No. But also at the amusement park, you had girls and guys together too. So it was kind of an even playing field for everybody.
Yes, and like, I don't want to even sugarcoat it because the, you know, I wasn't surprised when I ended up in grounds. I do feel like at the time Six Flags was channeling most of the black applicants to food and beverage. Like, I was like, as long as I don't have to, like, make it, oh, yeah, like, you'd see, the food and beverage department was almost unanimously black, which was highly suspicious because rides and merch were almost unanimously white. And I remember that by the time, just 1 year later, merch had sort of, like, diversified, but rides was, like, rides was suspect. And my sister even, you know, she was one of the first, I want to say she was one of the first black rides people.
That is the craziest thing.
There were guilds. There were literal guilds at Six Flags Over Georgia back then. I can't stress enough because a part of me really wants to go back to Six Flags Over Georgia.
You should. And visit it. Oh, your kids would love it, of course.
They would love it.
They would love it.
They love Six Flags out here.
Are you Facebook friends with any of those people from back then?
I wish I could say I was. I don't think I've stayed in touch with any of them. But again, you know, that's the unfortunate difference. Like, just a couple of years later, when I was in college, I worked at Circuit City. And those people actually have a Facebook group because, you know, it's a little bit closer to now. So it's a little bit like, it's easier to stay in touch on
the
social media.
The Circuit City Facebook page.
Yeah, no, wow, it's
man,
really ridiculous.
That's tight. That is crazy. So you wore a red polo at Circuit City.
Did we have the real...
You had the red polo,
my
khaki
location
pants.
Didn't do that. My location said, come in and wear a white shirt with a tie of some sort. Because we were supposed to be so respectable that we could sell you, like, high-end appliances. And I remember there was one guy, he kind of looked like Morris Day. That dude could really sell, like, the high-end stuff.
No kidding.
And we used to be like, he's making $50,000, $60,000 a year. And this is like the 90s.
That
like,
is a lot of money.
Yeah, that was like...
Still a lot of money. But I thought, when I think of Circuit City, I would think you would just be selling stereos and speakers.
Well, that's what I was able to sell. I was able, because I was always a music person.
Yeah.
So I was able to be like, look, this Iowa CD player is amazing.
Iowa.
And you have to, don't even look at those Sonys. This Iowa.
Good on
over
you,
here.
Man.
This Harman Kardon is going to blow your mind. Like, I was really into the... Because, you know, like...
But those were really good.
Make Biggie's, you know, bassy vocals sound amazing.
But Harman Kardon, I mean, those were the best products.
Oh, they really were.
Yeah, so you weren't lying.
No, I wasn't pushing. In fact, I mean, one of the reasons why I made less money than people is because I was a very truthful salesman.
Ah, that's great. I love it. Hey, listen, thank you so much for talking with us today. And I love the topic, My First Job.
My First Job. I still miss that job. It was so simple. I would go into work. I would do a good job. I made my money.
It's beautiful.
And I saved up and bought a car. Like, you know, in a way, the simplicity of it is still...
I think it's just beautiful. I really do. All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. Let Diallo know that you enjoyed his story over on Twitter and tweet him at Diallo. And join us next week on Storyworthy for actress Rebecca Johnson.
Ooh. I have fainted at the eye doctor, the dentist, and even the nail salon. Like, at the eye doctor... The time I fainted was when they just told me that they were going to dilate my eyes and not to touch my cornea, because if I touch my cornea, I could scratch it. So, of course, then I fainted.
Don't miss actress Rebecca Johnson from GLOW next week on Storyworthy. All right, you guys, I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Arnon Lopez and everybody on the Wondery team. And on behalf of the very talented Diallo Riddle, thank you so much.
Thank you for
I really appreciate your story. My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.